So maybe shame, painful as it is, has some value. Maybe it's not just an emotion, but a social tool. Jennifer Jaquette thinks that there is an upside to shame. She's an assistant professor in the Environmental Studies Department at New York University, and she's the author of a book called Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool. She talked with Steve Paulson about how to use shame for the power of good.
Jennifer, how did you get so interested in this whole question of shame?
I got interested for a few reasons. One was that I saw a lot of guilt and a lot of headlines that had to do with guilt, especially in the realm of the environment. So people were feeling very guilty about flying or even having a second child, things like that. And I thought of the way people were engaging with that guilt seemed to be often in terms of individual personal choices. And this to me seems sort of superfluous because that kind of engagement doesn't scale very well.
By scaling well, you wanted something, you were interested in something that would actually have a big impact.
Yeah, when you can make big changes quickly. And it seems like individual by individual is a much harder way to make a big difference quickly, unless you sort of sell consumer goods, right? Those definitely do scale. So I was curious on how we could, without necessarily involving governments or before government legislation came into play, because right now we are in the situation where government is failing us in many ways, how we could get these large changes quickly.
And basically your solution is to shame groups of people or even governments or big corporations when they're doing bad things?
Yeah, so it's not always the solution, of course, but I lay out in the book cases in which there's a clear path to shame. When, why, how. It's more in terms of using it as a stopgap before probably tougher legislation or some sort of global governance, but it can work at scale, and that was the kind of package research I did for this book.
So give me some examples of how this can work.
A nice example is Rainforest Action Network and a couple other nonprofits have been singling out big banks that are funding mountaintop removal. Basically, the coal companies actually that do the removal in Appalachia. And this is a really environmentally destructive practice, and these groups and many citizens want to put an end to it. So before they can get legislation put in place, and many people are working on that, these nonprofits are using public exposure on these banks, attacking their reputation year after year. Last year was the fifth year of the report. And two of the major nine banks that they target have last year decided to end ties with the coal companies.
So how does this work? I mean, how do you actually shame a corporation in public?
Well, I mean, you've seen this, right? You get negative headlines, you release reports, you have protests, you carry signs sometimes that say, shame on Wells Fargo or whoever it is you're interested in, and you attract the attention of the crowd. And this is very much sort of like the town square idea, but aimed at a much higher level.
And is this effective?
Well, as I just mentioned with the banks, two out of the nine have given it up. Now, would we ideally like all nine? Yes. Is that their ultimate goal? Yes. Will legislation probably have to be put in place to achieve that? Yes. But in the meantime, these groups have shown that it's possible to get banks to change their behavior. And they've gotten them to set a good example. And there are lots of these kinds of examples in the book.
To some degree, you're talking about generating negative publicity, but you're going a step further. I mean, you're actually using this idea of shame. I mean, sort of bringing, I guess, what we would call sort of moral opprobrium into trying to bring down some of these companies.
It's hard because you could just say, oh, you're exposing them or negative publicity, but sometimes that doesn't get really exactly to the heart of the matter. And what I am interested in with shame is that because it requires an audience and because that audience is essential to the effectiveness of shame and the intensity of it, I think problems that really affect that audience lend themselves more to public exposure. So it's kind of not just negative publicity because that only talks about that one side. Shame says, no, there's actually a big audience looking at that negative publicity as well. So in some cases, what I'm more interested in, I guess, is whether or not people change their behavior in light of the threat of public exposure and then audience interest in that.
And you've actually done some experiments on this, haven't you?
I have indeed. And in these experiments, we didn't ask students how they felt either, but we did threaten them with shame or promise them honor, but in a very gentle sort of way. They were playing a public goods game, which is a sort of cooperation experiment where they can give money to a public pool or not. And in our experiments, we told them at the very start of the game, hey, look, at the end of 10 rounds of this game, we're going to expose the least generous players, the 2 out of the 6. And in the other treatment, the honor treatment, we said we're going to expose the 2 most generous players. And in both of those treatments, actually, we saw an increase in cooperation by about 50%.
Of course. I'm surprised it wasn't more like 100%.
Yeah, well, it's hard in these games because there's not a ton of movement, so even 50% is a lot because they have just a choice between 0 and 1 at each round. I don't even know if 100% increase was possible, in other words. But it was significant, to say the least. And I think when people hear this, they go, well, then why didn't you write a book about honor? You know, it's such a more positive and if it's just equally as powerful. But I then bring up the case of, you know, state taxes. So California and about 20 other states have now introduced shaming tax delinquents.
What do they do? So some of the biggest tax delinquents, they are named publicly?
They're told that within 6 months of receiving a letter, that their name will be posted online as a tax delinquent. And they only expose the, often, depending on the state, but in California, the 500 worst tax delinquents, and you have to owe more than $100,000 in back taxes. So that really targets the most egregious, and it allows sort of the poorest offenders to remain anonymous.
And what's been the impact of that?
So they've gotten over $400 million
wow.
in back taxes since they introduced the program in 2007. It costs them only about $130,000 a year to run. And this is so interesting because it's outside the legal system, right? It's simply using the power of reputation. Now, the other interesting thing is it's the threat of shame that's more powerful than the shame itself. Most of the people pay up before they get on the list. That's the goal.
Now, you say that shaming can also be playful, artful even.
Those are the best forms of shaming.
Well, you write about this guy who used to be the mayor of Bogota, Colombia. Tell me
about amazing.
Him.
He's amazing. Yeah, Mayor Mocus. He knew both the art of shame and shamelessness because he wound up becoming mayor because he used to be president of the university. He was trying to get the crowd's attention one evening when they were being really rowdy. And to do that, he dropped his trousers and mooned the audience. So he becomes notorious and loses his job. But with that attention, he decides, you know, I'm going to run for mayor. And he wins. Cheapest election in Bogota history, apparently. And he used art and shaming so intertwined and so creatively during his time. I'll just give you one example, the one he's most famous for. He hired handfuls of mimes to follow people around the city and point out bad pedestrian and driving behavior because there were high amounts of fatalities due to car accidents and pedestrian collisions. Then they were so popular and so well understood and embraced by the public, he hired 400 more. And he was actually able to show that these mimes led to a decrease in fatalities. And it was such a great use of sort of street theater and shaming and getting people to self-regulate. He was really interested in the culture of self-regulation.
What did these mimes do? How did they shame people, the bad drivers?
Well, I've never seen footage of it. I've only seen photographs, but it seems that they held up signs. They would follow around pedestrians, follow them closely in a mocking or ridiculing way if they crossed at the wrong time. They would point out drivers that weren't wearing their seatbelts. They would also get really active, apparently, if there was excessive honking. So they were just kind of our conscience, but expressed in this street theater, which was just so cool.
And these mimes were actually on the public payroll?
Yeah, they were paid by the city. I think it's a great use of public funds. You fund the arts and a decrease in traffic accidents at the same time.
Jennifer Jackwood is the author of Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool. She talked with Steve Paulson.